448 Riverside Drive in a beautiful place with Flora and Jacob Mincer. And it is July 26, 2002 in the morning. And Jacob is going to tell us about his time at the Bureau and how he got into economics. So why don't you start with that? And
July 26th is a special day for him.
It is.
It's my second birthday.
It's the day
I arrived in the U.S.
In 48.
In 1948. It was July 26th.
That's wonderful. Well, this is very meaningful. Very meaningful.
Now, the history of my studies.
Yeah.
Before the war, I studied engineering.
Yes.
For about 1 year. And then the war broke out.
Yes. You studied engineering in Poland?
No, in Czechoslovakia.
Uh-huh.
I was not accepted in Poland.
Mm-hmm.
I applied to Institute of Technology. But they didn't accept Jews.
Yes.
They accepted 1 out of 100, something like that. So, but I had admission to the School of Engineering in Brno.
Yes.
Czechoslovakia. So I went there in the fall of 38. And a few months later, the Nazis came in. So I didn't continue my studies until 1948. It was an interruption of 10 years.
Right.
In 1948, when I got here on a Hillel Foundation scholarship, at the time I didn't know what I was going to study, because I lost interest in engineering. So I decided to sort of shop around at Emory for various courses. And I thought that maybe the social sciences are meaningful. And one thing about the social sciences is that I thought that I understood much of it. But one subject that I understood nothing was economics. That was a black box. And that was the reason I actually decided to go for it, especially since the teacher of economics at Emory was a very good teacher. And he's the one who pushed me toward doing graduate work in economics. But what he said was, you either go to Chicago, where you'll study with Milton Friedman, who is not yet known but will be known, or if you don't go to Chicago, go to Columbia, because they have a link up with the National Bureau. And that's the only place which does empirical work in economics.
And this person was Swenson?
Yes.
And his field was in economics was what?
Economic theory.
Okay.
Price theory. So his prediction, his wishes for me were materialized both. First I went to Chicago. But Milton wasn't there. He was away for the year. However, Flora was there. And that's how we met. That's where we met.
Yes.
But then she had an offer of residency.
Do you mind if I take a picture of you?
How's my hair?
It's beautiful. Yeah. Okay. So. Okay, I'm going to zoom out. Okay. So you're backlit. Now you're fine. Okay. I'm going to take a picture of the piano and then I'm going to put it down. Okay, so you met Flora. Take the picture. Yes?
She got an offer of residency, wasn't it?
Radiology
in New York, Montefiore Hospital.
Right.
So I had to make a choice.
Right.
Either to study at Chicago, forget about Flora, or go to New York with her. Of course, the answer is obvious, not just in retrospect.
Right.
So when I got to Columbia, I immediately started finding out something about the Bureau. Of course, I needed a job anyway. So I found out who the people in the department are that work at the Bureau, that are staff members of the Bureau. It was Frederick Mills, who was a statistician. He's the one I talked to. And I asked him, is it possible to get a job as a research assistant at the National Bureau? He said, I'll find out. And the next day, he tells me, yes, Ruth Mack is looking for an assistant. So I made an appointment with Ruth Mack. She was not on the staff at Columbia, but she was full-time
at the National
Bureau.
Right.
At that time, a lot of people were full-time.
That's right.
Without teaching. Anyway, I came to an interview at Columbia. The Bureau was at Columbus Circle, on a very high floor. Despite that, it was very dark there. Anyway, I came into. I came to her office, to Ruth Mack's office, and what do I see? The whole floor was covered by maps, by graphs, I should say. And sitting in the center was a very beautiful woman with a corn cob pipe.
Yeah.
And she asked me a number of questions. And I asked her a question, what are these lines on the floor? She said, these are business cycles. So I said, I don't see any cycles. I see wiggles that go a long way. Those are the cycles. Anyway, she hired me.
Even though you were a bit dubious about the way in which they did business cycles.
I didn't have any idea what was being done, so I was very curious. Besides, I needed money. But she was very nice. And I spent several years working for her.
So this began in 1951?
52.
52.
Spring
okay.
of 52.
Okay.
And I think I worked 3 or 4 years for her.
And our first vacation as a married couple was occupied, 1 week of it was occupied by Jacob going up to her farm in Vermont and leaving me stranded.
She had a big barn and a desk for me to work on, and she went horseback riding. But she was nice.
So this was her project on leather and boots and shoes.
That's right.
And
I was at that point already accustomed to think in terms of price theory, and I couldn't find any theory in what she was doing. So I kept criticizing her, but she was appreciative.
And at that time, did you meet many of the other people who were doing very similar work on different industries, business cycles. There was a big business cycle shop there, right, at the Bureau?
Well, Victor Zarnowitz worked there.
Of course.
And I met him.
Victor arrived, I think, in 52.
Same year.
From Poland. Right. Well, he was in Germany. He got a degree, he got his undergraduate degree and a graduate degree in Germany, and then he came, he gained entry to the U.S. pretty late.
Yes.
Right. And others who were there, who else do you remember who was there around 52, 53?
Don Jacobs.
Yes.
Who not long ago was the dean of the Kellogg School of mm-hmm. Business. He worked on financial aspects of business cycles with Steve, what's his name? Saulnier.
Yes, right.
Yeah, he was a research assistant to Saulnier. There was a bunch of other people, I don't remember the name.
Did you see Simon Kuznets?
Yes. I was thinking of the research assistants.
Right.
As far as the staff is concerned, of course, Simon was the important figure.
Hmm. You had something to say about Simon Kuznets the other day to me.
What was it?
That you spoke to the Swedes when you were...
Well, I can't take credit for his Nobel, but I did. I spent a semester in Sweden in 71 teaching labor economics. And I talked to the people on the Nobel Committee. And I told them, and up to this point, they only had only a few years.
Right.
They only gave it to theoreticians and econometricians. So I told them there's a vast field of empirical economics, and not only empirical economics, but national income accounts, and a whole new way of thinking about the economy. Of course, he got the Nobel Prize, but I'm not going to take credit for it. Of course, Arthur Burns was the ruling dictator.
Right. Tell me a little bit about Burns, about your recollections.
Well, Burns, of course, was teaching at Columbia, and he was a protege of Wesley Mitchell, who was the founder of the Bureau. When I got to Columbia, Mitchell was either retired or not alive.
He wasn't alive. He died in 47, I believe.
So Burns was the head of the Bureau, and his right hand was Fabricant. And the second hand was Jeffrey Moore. So that was the troika that ran the Bureau. But there was no question that Burns had the primary power. I'll never forget this time when the article by Koopmans came out.
Yes.
Measurement without theory. Well, it didn't take long for Arthur to write a rebuttal, an article called Theory Without Measurement. But before that happened, he invited Koopmans to the Bureau for a conversation. Everybody knew that that's what's going to happen. And when Koopmans came, people were standing in the corridor, in the hallway, and listening, trying to catch a conversation.
Yes.
Well, they didn't catch a conversation, but they caught the tremendous yelling by Arthur, who completely intimidated Koopmans.
Arthur tended to intimidate just about everyone, I think.
Well, he tried to intimidate me, too.
Yes? Do you remember that?
Not really intimidated.
Uh-huh.
In 1960, when I was a year after I was hired at Columbia, the Bureau promoted me to staff member.
Right.
And Arthur Burns immediately offered me a vice presidency. I rejected it, because he offered it to a number of people. he needed help.
Yeah.
I think Victor Fuchs accepted it at that point.
I think that's right. Right.
Anyway, I didn't want any headaches.
There would have been administrative responsibility.
Yeah, and I always shied away from it.
That's right. Victor... Victor headed various things at the Bureau. I don't remember if he was a vice president. I could look that up. Of course, when you arrived at the Bureau, I think Burns was still in Washington because he was in administration in the Eisenhower administration on the CEA. He left the Bureau, and he left Fabricant and Moore in charge. And prior to that, I believe Burns was the director of research. And then when he returned, he became president, and Fabricant became director of research, and
right.
Moore was the assistant director of
Sounds
research,
right.
Something like that, right. So so it was, I guess, the second year when he came back, in 53, I believe he came back, right.
Well, something about Burns' teaching. He was an excellent speaker.
Yes.
And very interesting lecturer. I took his course, a year-long course. It consisted of two parts. And the fall semester, well, that was the year when Hicks's demand theory came out. Forget what the title was. So he used that as a basis for reviewing macroeconomic demand theory, which includes Keynes, Hicks, a variety of people who published at that time. It was a terrific lecture course. The first semester. The second, he didn't, during the first semester, he didn't criticize anything. He just reported. He
yes.
did an excellent job. In the spring semester, he criticized everything from A to Z. All the things he covered in the fall semester.
I took back.
I was tempted to ask for my money back. One thing canceled the other, but it was a very interesting experience.
You know, Friedman was a student of Arthur when Arthur was at Rutgers. He was his undergraduate teacher.
Yes.
And Milton has enormous respect for Arthur's mind. You know, and of course he had a slight falling out with him over wage and price controls. But he still thinks of himself as a lifelong student of Arthur Burns. Yeah.
Well, the story about Burns at Rutgers and Milton was that Burns was teaching elementary statistics.
Yes.
And at some point, Milton pointed out that what he was saying was wrong. And Burns dropped out of teaching statistics. That's the story I heard.
Now, you said something about the famous piece, Measurement Without Theory, and then the rebuttal, Theory Without Measurement. How did you feel about this? Someone who combined eventually at the Bureau did something that others weren't doing, which is truly combining theory with measurement. Did you feel that there was theory, but people weren't talking about it, or that it really was measurement without theory?
Well, you mean what the Bureau was doing?
Yes, what the Bureau was doing.
I felt there was an imbalance.
Yes.
But I couldn't put my fingers on it. I wasn't quite familiar with theories of business cycles.
Right.
But I did take that course with Burns. But there was no juxtaposition of, no confrontation of theory with empirical measurement.
Right. And there was a lot of measurement.
There was no support for the empirical, how should I put it? Theory wasn't being mobilized in attacking the data.
People weren't distancing themselves from the data first, and then looking at these very chaotic series with a sense of what they might be looking for. They were just looking for ups and downs. Burns's books and Mitchell's books in particular have nascent theory. It's just not rigorous, it's not mathematized, it's not formal. I think that's part of it. It's difficult.
Well, it's ad hoc.
Right. So you begin in 52 working for Ruth. And then 53, 54, you're still working for Ruth, or you switched around?
No, I was working for her only.
Right. Did you get to speak to any of the other senior people, or there was sort of a gulf between the senior people and the junior, the research assistants?
Well, they were not inaccessible, but I was shy.
Okay. Although you weren't very shy when you told Ruth that they were just
true.
A lot of squiggles.
I also wasn't very shy when I believed that she didn't theorize enough. She didn't put things in a theoretical framework.
Right.
At all.
Right. At that time, you were... there were lots of things to read at the Bureau as well. Did you come across the work of Friedman and Kuznets and Friedman's work by himself at that point? Were you, you had probably a nascent interest in distribution. Was it sparked by their work?
Their work had a very big impact on me.
Well, tell me about it.
I was writing a dissertation at Columbia, and my interest was in wage determinations. Why do people have different wage differentials? And I was approaching it like a Bureau person by looking at various comparisons. Industry, occupation, age, sex, race, any principle you can think of. I got chapters along that line. There was a fellow student of mine named Al Petrinas. I don't know if that name is familiar.
It isn't. I'll look it up.
He didn't work at the bureau, but he was a very smart guy. And we used to discuss our dissertations in progress. I forget what he did. But anyway, when I was telling him what I was doing, he said, that's not the way to do it. You should look for a unifying principle. And then it became, he also suggested look up the book by Kuznets and Friedman, which was Friedman's dissertation, Income of Independent Professional Practitioners.
Right.
So when I looked at that, when I read this book, it took me back to Adam Smith.
Right.
And then I realized that all the comparisons I was making had as a basic principle education and age. If you pushed the comparisons, each one of them had underlying differences in human capital.
Right. Would you have used that term, human capital, at
yes,
that point?
Yes, I used that immediately.
Okay. Right.
This is quite interesting. It was like a revelation. That same afternoon, we met again after I read the book. And I had this principle established, written out, and shown with empirical data. And my sponsor, Barger, immediately said, this is great.
Yes.
And sent a copy to Ted Schultz. I didn't know that there was a whole new industry brewing in Chicago on the empirics of economic growth involving human capital. But then I realized that he was looking at wage differentials over time, and I was looking across people, but it's basically the same subject. So there was, I had a tremendous satisfaction writing the dissertation. It took me a few days to turn around all the material I had into an organized.
That's great, yeah.
Analysis of wage differentials. I then got the offer from Ted Schultz to come to Chicago for a postdoctoral.
So what year was that?
57.
That's when you went in the postdoc. Yes.
And I immediately went to Chicago for the postdoctoral.
So you had been working on this dissertation for a fairly long time.
That's right.
And suddenly, you
the
saw
whole
the
thing
light.
Got organized.
And suddenly, all these chapters moved around and had an underlying foundation structure.
Right.
That's a wonderful thing to remember, that there's this moment of seeing the light.
Right, absolutely. But, well, when I got to Chicago, Greg Lewis took me under his wing.
Yes.
Proclaiming that I was a labor economist. I was very insulted. Because
Let's
at that
talk
time,
about that, yes.
Labor economists had a very bad reputation.
Okay.
Of being a subject that never touched economics.
Because it was institutional, it was labor unions.
Right.
Right.
I think that Samuelson made some crack about labor at the time, saying it's the last refuge of the scoundrel. Anyway, I was completely taken aback when Greg Lewis proclaimed that I should be studying labor economics. And I never took a course in labor economics.
So prior to that, you thought of yourself as an economist who knew theory and who, how would you have described yourself? You're studying distribution?
Applied price theory.
Okay.
Whatever the topic might be. But then the book by Milton on the consumption function
right.
was a tremendous revelation as well. Yes. How to do empirical research. Very different than what the Bureau was doing. Setting up your model and then milking all kinds of implications. And the principle I got out of that was that it's not, the empirical work is not just estimating a parameter somewhere, but drawing out implications that are apparently completely unrelated.
Right.
Yet they're caught in the net of that particular model. And that's been my procedure ever since.
Right. So you go to Chicago, and Greg takes you under his wing, and he declares that you're a labor economist. And then what happens?
Well, so I decided to sit in the courses of labor economics.
Right.
Where Greg Lewis was very enlightening in the way he tackled various questions. And Al Rees taught at the same time, so I sat in his course as well. And Al Rees spent that particular quarter reporting on the book by Clarence Long.
I'm glad we've gotten up to that here, because Clarence Long is part of the Bureau, and he's doing work that's very different from what was generally done at the Bureau. So,
was different, but his empirical work didn't have the theoretical background.
Exactly.
It was interesting, very interesting. And one of the questions that Al Rees kept coming back to all the time is the labor force participation of women. Because there was this paradox that if the husband's income is high, the wife is unlikely to be in the labor force. Yet over time, income grew.
Right.
All the husbands' incomes grew,
right.
as well as the wives. And there was an increase in participation rather than a decrease, as you would have expected. And neither Greg nor Al Rees had answers to that question. They kept coming up with all kinds of hypotheses, which partially illuminated the story. But basically, they didn't have an answer. Well, again, there was one particular day where I was sitting in Al Rees's class, and I asked myself, what about taking two variables instead of one?
Right.
Income, we have prices, wages. Shouldn't that tell what's going on? And it could, in principle, if the price effect is stronger than the income effect. But then you have to bring in the family in order. So after a few weeks, I had a rough model, And I looked at the data as well, and it looked very promising. So I went to Greg Lewis and told him what my approach would be.
Mm-hmm.
And Greg, didn't take him long, immediately said, this is the right approach.
Right.
Immediately invited me to a conference, the National Bureau Conference, that took place at Princeton in 1960.
And that's the 62 volume.
Yeah.
Right.
Clarence Long was my discussant. And he was the most complimentary discussant I ever experienced.
He was a very nice person.
Yeah. In general, everybody was very positive about my findings. And everybody was happy about it. In fact, when I finished, I got a standing ovation.
That's very satisfying.
An applause, not standing.
Yeah. So well, any reaction is really good. Now, we're going to come back to the Bureau, in part because you then come back, but I just want to point out that you go to Chicago in 57, and interestingly, Gary goes to Columbia in 57.
That's right.
So here you are, the two people who are going to come back together. You hadn't met him at Chicago when he was a student because you decided to go to Columbia, and now you could meet him, but he's going to Columbia and you're going to Chicago. Had you met him before?
No, but his reputation preceded him.
Yes.
I was told all kinds of stories about Gary, about his approach to demographic economics, which was something completely new to me. And the fact that he had already written two published articles while an undergraduate.
Right.
And the other fact that when Gary applied to Chicago for graduate work, Viner, who was his sponsor, wrote a letter to the people at Chicago saying, Gary's the best student I ever had. Which insulted a lot of people because they were his students.
One has to be very careful.
Did you hear that story before?
No.
Anyway, I almost stayed at Chicago because there was a question. I was made an offer during that fellowship year. But I ran into competition with Zvi Grilakis.
I'm glad that we're bringing up Zvi's name because I wanted to do that, yes. So tell me about that.
Well, Zvi didn't believe my dissertation at first.
Ah.
And then he didn't believe that I would get an offer with approximately the same salary that he had. So he protested.
Yes.
To Greg Lewis, who was in charge of these matters. And it boiled down to, I forget whether half a thousand or a thousand a year.
Yeah, that's a lot. Yeah.
At that
time. So, Greg Lewis, I told him how much I want, which was something like 6,500 similar to Tzvi, whether higher or lower, I forget. And Greg Lewis said he was constrained. He couldn't offer me more. So I felt if they can't offer me 6,500 or 1,000, they're not gonna, it's not worth my while. I mean, I took it as a vote of no confidence.
Yes.
So I under those conditions, I didn't want to win.
So Greg was chair of the department then, not Schultz?
Schultz was the chair, yes. But all the dirty work was done by Greg.
Greg did a lot of dirty work in his time at Chicago. He did a lot.
And Schultz is the one who prompted him.
I see. What I mean by dirty work is not that he did anyone's dirty work, but he spent, and I think that you probably admired him for this, he spent a lot of time with students. Any student whom other people didn't want, he took, and he made better.
It was well known that he wrote all the dissertations.
Yes, he took everyone's dissertation and made it one large notch better. And we are all grateful to Greg for that. He was a wonderful person to all of us. So you spent this wonderful year at Chicago. Were you there at Chicago,
yeah.
Flora?
Yeah, we were, right.
You took a year off?
I had two children at the time.
Yes.
And, I wasn't working full-time then. I had finished my residency and... Did I work for 1 year? Yes, I worked for 1 year at an enormous salary for that time. I got $10,000 for
yes.
my first. And we all moved to Chicago.
Well, the work on participation of women benefited from my observing Flora.
Yes, because... That's very interesting, because your salary was going to go up, but her salary went up sufficiently so that she was pulled back into the labor force. Very good. But then there was also the fact that there was this migration decision, and so then your mind is thinking about female labor supply and households and how they interact. So then...
Then we went back to New York.
So then the year is over. You go back to New York.
And I immediately made an appointment to see Gary.
And of course, when you went back, you're at City College as an
yes.
assistant professor.
Right. No,
associate. Sorry. That's right. Because you had been an instructor in City College in 1954. We didn't...
Yeah, they jumped.
They jumped
two
here.
Steps.
Okay.
But the first step before the instructor was an otherwise unknown title.
Yes, I had the longest title of my life.
Yes.
Assistant Substitute Tutor.
Renewable monthly.
Which I didn't know.
So you come back to New York, you're at City College. And then Columbia makes you an offer. And then the next year, you go to Columbia. My records show that it's in 59, you go to Columbia.
Again, I ran into competition with Tzvi. Columbia made him an offer, but he didn't accept it. So I owe him two decisions.
Yes. So you go to Columbia and you renew your relationship with the Bureau as well.
Yes. The Bureau promoted me to staff member.
In like 1960, 61.
Yeah.
Right. And so let's...
And of course, I was very eager to meet Gary and because I heard all these things about him. So we made it, I met him for lunch, and then we made it a custom to meet for lunch once a week, each week. The first thing I was very curious about is his reaction to my dissertation. He was already planning a project on investment in education. In fact, he had an article in 1960 about that. But the first thing he told me was that there are a lot of weak spots in my dissertation, that it could benefit from a lot more work.
I'm laughing because Gary never holds anything back.
You know? Well, that was an eye-opener to me.
Yes.
Because I thought I finished. And that's... Well, then our conversations revolved around research in that area. There was the National Bureau Conference again on investment in human capital, where Gary had his theoretical chapter on sort of unifying education and job training.
Right.
And I had an empirical part on job training.
Right.
Using his theory at that point. And Stigler had the economics of information.
Stigler was at the Bureau. He was also at Columbia.
Yes.
And when we think about, we're going to get into now bringing human capital to the Bureau and what preceded it. Stigler had nascent work on human capital at the Bureau.
Yes, he had something on education.
And on wage differentials for teachers, professors. He had a study on that. He had his work on servants. I say nascent because once again,
it wasn't frontally.
Yes, it was. He was asked to. One gets the sense that he was asked to do this project. His heart wasn't exactly in it,
no.
And the mind, the theory wasn't coming out the way George would bring something out.
Right.
It's flat.
That's true. Didn't have much of an impact.
No.
Incidentally, Stigler was my ally.
Yes.
Well, first of all, it should be known that Stigler never complimented a student for his work. He always looked for criticism. When I was writing my dissertation, he was on my dissertation committee, so he read the draft of my dissertation, and Ruth Mack told me, George will never tell you that to your face, but he told me that's a very good dissertation.
He did tell it to you.
Yeah.
50 years later.
Yes. And in 91, when I got the honorary doctorate from Chicago, we had a big party in Bob Fogel's apartment. And George Stigler came over to me and said, that was a great dissertation. The other thing he did is also funny. During the defense of the dissertation, one of the people in the committee was a mathematical statistician named Lionel, forgot the name. He was a mathematical statistician at Columbia. he immediately launched an attack against me.
Yes.
This guy, saying that he doesn't find any tests of significance.
Yes.
All the statistics that I provided in the dissertation.
Right. Lots of memes.
Well, first of all, I was using census data.
Which
that were millions.
That's right. It is the population. It's not a sample. Right.
But even if it were a sample, it would always be significant with these tremendous numbers.
Yeah.
So that's what George told him. And then he said, when you take on a dissertation, you should read it first. And the guy got so insulted, he walked out.
I could hear George saying that. He would just say it in a matter-of-fact manner.
Yeah.
Right? So you come back, and here is this sort of human capital team meeting up at Columbia and also at the Bureau. So Gary has a position at the Bureau. You are just getting a position at the Bureau. Stigler is at the Bureau. And Victor Fuchs, right, is at the Bureau. Who else? Who am I missing who would be on around 61 who you would go to the Bureau and talk about education, training, human capital? Tom Juster?
Well, Finus Welch.
Finus comes in at around that time.
Yes,
right?
And so does Sherwin Rosen.
I forget that. So Sherwin was just visiting for a while, or he was in New York?
He was in New York for a while, I think for a year.
Okay.
And then he would come in during the summer.
Right.
And I was just about finishing my book, Schooling Experience and Earnings, and Sherwin was the main reader for the Bureau.
Yes.
And so was Welch. I forget who else. Anyway, there were lots of discussions going on.
So that brings us, though, almost a decade later into the 70s, right? This
was the late 60s.
When you finished the manuscript, and then it was reviewed. Of course, then it took a while to publish. This group working on human capital, so let's move to talking about the way in which I would put it as sort of the founding of human capital at the Bureau. So you're working by yourself on these various subjects having to do with education, training, the female labor force, family decisions, all coming together very nicely. Gary is working slightly differently, but on some similar subjects, right? And
it's not correct to say that I was working alone.
Okay.
Because we had conversations with Gary every day.
Right.
At Columbia. So he was sort of bouncing his ideas against me and vice versa. But we never wrote a joint article.
There's one, right?
There is one which got lost.
It got lost. Yes.
That was on a completely different subject.
Yes.
It was rational expectations, basically.
Right.
Well, in 1963, there was a memorial book for Yehuda Grunfeld.
Yes.
In that book, there's an article by Milton on the consumption function, where he uses the kind of weights that Kagan used in his dissertation. Backwards.
Right.
Adaptive expectation.
Right.
And he was trying to get the discount, the consumer discount rate out of it, and got some estimates that way. Well, Gary and I said, why go backwards? Why don't we go forward?
Right.
The data exists. So let's assume that people, on average, have the right guesses. Anyway, that was in the 60s. So we divided the job in two parts, one written by me and one by him. Well, I finished my part and sent it to Gary, and that was the last I heard of it. So I asked Gary, where is that draft? He said he didn't have the draft.
So it never arrived?
And I didn't have it either. But it took several decades for Gary to find it in his file somewhere. So what he found was my part.
Yes.
And he sent it to me. And I said, well, why don't you finish? Well, first of all, it was no longer of interest because Bob Hall
exactly.
had already done
right.
something similar. But that was the only article that we tried to write jointly, and it didn't work out.
Right.
So there's some message there, I don't know what.
Now, at the Bureau, I take it from reading the annual reports that Gary was sort of made the head, I guess it must have been Saul Fabricant, who said to him, well, you're in charge of this, it was called the Project on Education. And you had money from Carnegie, is that right?
Well, I don't think I got money, I don't know.
He reports that, in fact, I think you thank Carnegie in some of your papers, so whether you got it or not, you do thank them for maybe research assistance or something. But Gary, I always like when I read the annual reports, because of course, we know what happened, and so Gary and others will write in the annual reports that they got money from, and this is what they promise, you say, to do. And then every year they sort of promise the same thing. Because Gary and Jacob delivered, and sometimes you read what people promised and it didn't actually come true. We know. But Gary would report, he would say, I'm working on the following, and Jacob Mincer is doing the following. So he would put in what you were doing, and he took this little administrative responsibility. And then there weren't that many other people he reported on. He reported on Al Fishlow, who was doing a little historical study, and that Al never finished. Tell me a bit about human capital at the Bureau. Who else was working on human capital? Did you feel that Fabricant and Jeff Moore and Arthur were pleased that there was this group working on human capital, or was it quite different to them?
Well, I think that Fabricant and Moore were open-minded.
Yes.
Burns was a little bit dissatisfied because he felt that it's a movement toward theory. And he felt unhappy about it. Exactly why, I don't know.
Maybe it wasn't his agenda. His agenda was macro, business cycles.
That's right.
A little bit of both. Who else was there working on?
Well, as I mentioned before, Cheryl and Rose and...
Right. Do you remember Tom Juster having any importance in the group?
Tom Juster was doing Consumer Expectations.
Right. So he was, at that time, he wasn't that related to this project.
Well, actually, it's interesting. In 1960, when I was appointed to the staff, I replaced a statistician named Millard Haystead.
Yes.
So my initial task as a staff member was to help people with the statistical procedures. And that's how I got involved with Tom Juster. He was doing things on consumer expectations.
Because you edited a book called Economic Forecasts and Expectations.
Right.
Which seems a little odd, right?
Yeah, it came out of consulting various people at the Bureau.
Right.
Including students of mine, Stanley Diller, on the term structure of interest rates, embedding expectations in that.
Right.
And Roseanne Cole on measurement of gross national product, where she was looking at the revisions. A few other people.
I'm going to turn this off because this tape is over. I'll put in another tape and we'll just do a little bit more. Jacob Mincer and Flora Mincer and some delicious apricots in their apartment. And we're just going to do a little bit more concerning we're into the 1960s and the beginnings of human capital. So I said before that from what I've been told, this was sort of a vibrant time at the National Bureau, sort of a renewal of the National Bureau, and you can correct me if this is wrong.
It was a change.
Change, okay. And there was this, of course, there was still the business cycle shop. There was still people working on productivity. In some ways, that's still the mainstay of the Bureau. But now there's also a group of people who are working on measurement with theory with measurement, training, education, human capital, the labor force, bringing people in because you got some money from the Carnegie Foundation. I think it was Carnegie. And you have wonderful students at Columbia. So think back and tell me, how often did you go to the Bureau? Did you and Gary decide you'd go on Mondays, you'd go Wednesdays?
Well, we went every day.
Every day?
Yes.
You'd go to Columbia and then you'd, in the morning, then you'd go down to the Bureau or you'd start at the Bureau?
When I say every day that was free of teaching.
Okay.
But even days when we taught, we often went to the Bureau. Lunchtime we stayed on, the other way around. But my recollection is not terribly good, except that this was a wonderful period, and we had conversations with people in the group every day, one way or another.
And when you say the group, this is you and Gary. So let's think about, you know, around 1964 or so. You and Gary, and then there'd be occasionally visitors. So who else are we putting in the group? Is Victor's in the group?
Victor wasn't doing work
until later.
On this precise topic, he did it in terms of health economics.
Right.
but it was part of human capital, too.
So who else are you thinking about in the group?
Well, I mentioned before, Sherwin.
Sherwin, that for a short while, right. And then there are students. And so who do you think about in the 60s as being the students who were working at the Bureau?
I should have that list.
Reuben?
You mean the list from the conference?
Yeah.
I can get it for you.
Bob Michael?
Yes.
We were living in Mount Vernon at the time. Uh-huh. And we went on our big trip in 64. That might recall the associations.
Where was the trip to?
We went on a 5-month trip with the three children to...
Around the Atlantic.
Israel, with a stop in Greece, 3 months in Israel, then Johannesburg,
mm-hmm.
and then South America, Buenos Aires primarily.
Rio de Janeiro.
And Rio. You actually went a month earlier to Argentina, and then we met in the airport in Rome to go take that trip. It was a double purpose. One was to see the diaspora of Jacob's family.
Yes.
And the other to coordinate it with meeting economists and working and teaching in different places.
It was a very meaningful trip.
We took a boat across the South Atlantic.
Yes.
On the way.
From Johannesburg
to Rio.
Yes. Not the usual way of going. So Kuznets you never saw Kuznets at the Bureau then.
No, Kuznets.
He was at Hopkins, and then he went to Penn.
Yes, he had contact with Dick Easterlin.
Did you see Dick at all?
Yes.
And you talked to Dick about human capital, demography.
Well, he was more interested in demography.
Right.
And he was not quite sympathetic to the framework that Gary and I used on the family. But he was interested and interesting.
Right. And, so it was, in many ways, it was you and Gary and students and then a couple of visitors. And what's interesting is just how much was done that was so, how large a change, I should say, there was at the Bureau on the basis of two large figures. And
well, it was basically an addition to what they used to do before, because they didn't stop.
No, they didn't. Right. Did you get together with others at the Bureau at the time, and was there any sort of cross-fertilization of ideas? Because I'm trying to understand how the Bureau was functioning then as this large, you know, the business cycle shop. And then there's this other group. Did you get together? Did you have lunch with various people? Did you meet in the corridor?
We always had lunch in a group.
Yes.
And discussed all these things.
Right.
But at the moment, I don't remember all the names.
Right. But did you, Fabricant, for example, did you talk a lot to Fabricant about what you were working on? And did he give you ideas, or was there somewhat of a divide between the people who were doing productivity and business cycle stuff and human capital?
Well, Fabricant was interested in my labor supply stuff.
Right. Right.
And I was interested in his productivity. studies. So we used to discuss these things. But what came of it, I don't know. Zvi Grulich has spent...
Zvi must have spent some time there, that's right. Before we end, let me just ask you one other question, because we're sort of in the 60s, and there are big changes are going to happen at the end of the 60s at the National Bureau. You were interested in what you were doing and what Gary was doing and what this group was doing. I don't know if you took a larger interest in what was happening at the Bureau about the fact that there was a sense that Arthur was losing his hold on the Bureau and on the direction. Can you comment a bit, if you recall? It may be that this was something that was in the air, but it didn't really concern you. Were you concerned and interested in that?
Well, I felt that the Bureau was losing its character.
Okay.
And that it was going to be doing what all the other economists are doing in various universities, except they're going to try to monopolize the market.
Right.
So, to me it looked, and not only to me, like the end of what was characteristic of the National Bureau.
And what was characteristic, how would you define what was characteristic of the National Bureau?
Large-scale empirical work.
Okay. And also, many people have told me, and in recollections that I've read, that the beauty of the National Bureau was that you could work on what you wanted to work on, and you could do it for a long time. It wasn't, answer that question right now. It wasn't like working in the government or working in a private concern. It was serious.
Yes. The projects could go on for a very long time.
Right. So, but something is happening, and you sense it, that the Bureau, there's something fading at the Bureau. And how did you sense that? What seemed to be the problem?
Well, it simply meant that the Bureau was going to consist of individuals who are doing their own work.
Yes.
And there's no plugging in into something bigger.
Right, right. And then there was, you sense...
And the style would be model building.
Right, right.
Both theoretical and econometric. In other words, there was no unity anymore.
Right. So you did date this somewhere around 66 or...
No, it was much later.
Later. But if it's later, then it's after Burns leaves?
When did Burns leave?
Burns leaves in like 67, 68. That's when John Meyer... Do you remember when the transition to John Meyer? Did that mean anything to you? That you it switched, or was it sort of meaningless?
Well, we felt that it's the end of the Bureau as we know it.
Yes.
And sort of, you're on your own. Although the Bureau's helpful as overhead infrastructure, whatever you want to call it. But there is no such thing as the National Bureau style, purpose. It just became individualized.
So this is with the transition to John, that with the transition to John, something was lost, and then we moved to John, and then something was perhaps further lost. It's an interesting transition that it's hard for me to get at, because I could just go to John Meyer and ask him. But I think that I might not get the precise answer.
Well, John Meyer was an imperialist. He was trying to expand the Bureau to the maximum.
Yes, he had grand...
Not in terms of content.
No, that's... Yeah. He had grand visions. John Meyer is an extraordinary person, and he's an entrepreneur in many, many different ways. He's had many different scholarly lives. You know John Meyer? Well, I think this is... you've been very, very helpful, Jacob, extremely helpful. And I've enjoyed this very much.
Not really, because I don't remember a lot of things.
Nobody remembers everything. That's the point. It's a collective. That's what the National Bureau is. It's a collective. No one's an individual at the National Bureau. Let me end it by thanking you very much, and thanking Flora for having me in this beautiful house. I'm going to turn this. Flora wanted me to take some of the wonderful pictures in their house, and this is one. So tell me a little bit about the picture I'm focusing on, Flora.
Well, it happens to have a cat skull, which I got from my father.
I'm going to move to get it in better. Yes?
It went through the family. It's now with
So that is Felix Domesticus?
It's a cat skull that was in the family.
Yes.
Not our own cat, just the skull.
Yes.
And it's the painting I like, but it also has that connection. And then I like this...
Okay.
I like this switch.
A piece of very interesting realism. Should I follow you around?
Just in here.
Okay.
This is his self-portraits.
The
two over there are particularly... I should get the junk out of the way, if you can avoid it. Can you avoid this?
Yes, I'm avoiding it.
This is my favorite self-portrait.
And so, tell me his name.
Daniel Mincer.
Yes. And he was what age in this self-portrait?
He was probably around 20, early 20s. And this is after his heart operation.
Uh-huh. So he did a portrait of himself. And that's...
Well, don't bother with the other one, because I think these two are so much better.
Okay. Anything else you want me to take?
No, I just wanted a sample. Oh, this one is one of our family favorites.
I like it very much.
But...
And who did this one?
Who did it?
Yes.
Oh, he did all
he
of
did
them.
All of these, that's what I thought.
But since you were taking the ones in the other room, which were more... less unusual, I wanted you to have just a little bit of this.
I like this picture very much.
And not for the camera, but if you look behind you, you'll see the evolution
I'm going to shut off the camera then.
Yeah.